I read a book recently about a true story of scuba divers who like to dive into shipwrecks. It was about this one mysterious wreck off the coast of Maryland, or they figured it was a wreck anyway. Someone had seen something down there. And these divers decided to dive the wreck, and it turned out to be a submarine, possibly a U-boat. It looked like one, a World War II German submarine, but there was no record of a sub being sunk off the coast of Maryland. And so it might give Americans the creeps to find out that a boat was that close undetected. One diver finally found something on board that gave its identity. A spoon. On the handle was the Nazi eagle, the eagle perched up on top of the swastika. Two divers were down there at the time, and they both stared at that symbol on that spoon with their goggles on and their breathing devices. They had no way of speaking to each other, but they just stared at it. There's so much meaning in that symbol, mystique, the symbol of the faceless enemy of darkness, formed into the handle of a spoon. More upbeat examples of the power of symbols. Olympic athletes feel a high when draped in their country's flag. The American national anthem is even named after their flag, the Stars and Stripes, and it brings a tear to Americans' eyes. We sometimes fall in love with the logos of our favorite brands, the crests on the jerseys of our favorite sports team. Gangs will paint their symbols around their turf. People look at occult symbols and get strange feelings sometimes. Bands have logos that make their band more than just about the music. People even get those tattooed on themselves sometimes, like the N-I-N, Nine Inch Nails, N-I-N with the backwards N, or the Rolling Stones tongue and lips illustration. The Christian cross, or the Star of David. The Starbucks logo that used to mean you cared about coffee more than those people at Dunkin' Donuts. Or the Apple logo that for a time meant that you thought differently. Possibly unlike any other species that we know of anyway, we identify ourselves with our symbols. There's a symbol that has been in space for nearly 40 years, painted on a spacecraft, still communicating with Earth to this day. 20 billion kilometers from Earth, moving away from us at 61,000 kilometers per hour. It's the farthest human-made object from Earth. On it are the stylized letters NASA, a NASA word mark in bold red. That word mark was designed by a fellow named Richard Daney, a man who's made it his life's mission to make symbols that will be meaningful for a long period of time, designs that'll stick around for a while. The spacecraft that I'm talking about here, the farthest human-made object from Earth, Voyager 1, it finished its primary mission a long time ago, but it's pointed at the next planetary system where scientists think just maybe there's other life. It'll be a dead probe by then, but maybe it will be discovered by others. Regardless, it will arrive there with Richard Daney's logo in 40,000 years. Richard is now 82, still drawing logos to this day, and he said he wouldn't mind if we checked in.
Hello.
Hi, Dick. It's Lyndon calling.
The eagle has landed.
Here we are. Yeah.
And they said it couldn't be done.
But yep. those are the naive realists who said
this
that.
Is true. I'm trying to figure out where you're located. I mean, what is your time zone?
Oh, I'm central.
Oh, okay.
So good. This is noon for me. I just heard the church bells ringing.
Uh-huh.
The controversial church bells, the people who I know that work at a restaurant, actually one particular person who works at a restaurant nearby, doesn't mm-hmm. like it that they're always ringing and she can't hear the orders that are being taken around noon on the patio.
Oh, my God. It's getting complicated out there.
A lot of problems.
Are those darn church bells.
Those darn church bells. I don't mind it when they play the other day, what was it? Air on a G-String by J.S. Bach. That was really nice, but sometimes
lovely.
It gets into like kumbaya territory, and I don't like it
as
much.
Oh, no, that's dangerous. I know. And it gets in the way of the orders.
Yes, yes.
Good Lord. Well, I know. Nothing's easy anymore, but we just have to tough it out, you know?
Well, anyway, you grew up in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
You were born in 1934? Yes.
1934, yeah.
Yeah, so that was like, I was in the Dust Bowl.
Absolutely. We were in the thick of it. And, of course, the Great Depression. So it was a double hit, really. Terrible times for the country. And even worse for anyone in Oklahoma. Really sad times, but human nature being what it is, you do get through it.
Hmm.
My dad was a farmer. We'd get these tremendous storms that would really turn the sky dark brown black, you know. I mean, it was just like an eclipse of the sun. And, of course, ferocious winds. It's one thing about the plains down there, and there was almost nothing to slow it down or break it up, and that was the problem in and of itself. But no, the stuff was horizontal wind, you know. So this stuff just go flying by with furious sort of days. And, I mean, a storm could last a day and a half or something, you know. And my recollection was how dirty it was in the house. And I do remember the way it would come off the sills and the window sills in our house, you know, would just cascade off of it. The fact that we're sliding windows, you know, then it would just force it through the cracks. The blessing of country like that was you could raise the livestock and then you have your food supply, you know, meats and everything, and they could have all these animals and an orchard and a vegetable garden. And of course, almost everything was impossible. It was just a tough life. And I'm sure that the center of the Dust Bowl was, you've seen those photographs where the sand came up over the house. I mean, that was just unbelievable. But that went on for years. And I think what it did for our family was that we were just such a terrific unit. You know, it just brings you closer. I think I told you my dad had almost no education, but he was still a very smart man and invented a lot of things and built things. So when we finally came out of it, we were a very affectionate family and extremely close. So, but those were the physical trappings I remember.
So then at some point you decided it's time to leave Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through high school, I sort of couldn't wait to get out. Once I got in college, then I wasn't obligated to go home and help on the farm, so that was it, and I was on my own.
So when you were in college, what were you studying?
I wanted to do something in art or music, you know. Now, they wanted me to be an engineer, my parents. My oldest brother was an engineer, it was a good profession, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess all the time I knew I'd never be an engineer. But anyway, I started in it 1 year later. I switched into art to their great consternation. And the instructor who sort of believed in me, and she got me to go out to UCLA. And so I walked in at UCLA and a student exhibition was up. It was a design show. And I'd never seen anything like it. The album covers, you know, were the rage then. Posters. Ads, and I think I sort of just stood there in the middle of this exhibition saying, I'm home, you know.
Wow. And 60 years later now, almost, you're still doing graphic design.
My sixth decade.
You're 82.
Yep. You know, it's working out beautifully. It's still a lot of fun. It's just a great profession, great career.
It seems like your work in some ways is such a basic thing. My brother, who's a cellist, he was talking about how he felt like even learning one whole piece of music, you know, something that you wouldn't think would be short or long, he felt like it was too large of a project for him. And he was talking about these miniature pieces that, I don't know, some composer had written that were just a few bars long. And it was, he felt like that might actually be better for his personality because he'd rather focus on doing one very small thing very, very well. Like everything about it has been thought through and there'd never be this moment where he'd have to say, oh, well, those bars are going to be good enough because I've got 100 other ones I need to worry about. And it made me think about logo design, actually, in that you have this very simple project that you put care into everything about.
Well, and you do it, and it's never just about the logo. There would be a program behind it, and you do all the applications. In some cases, that's no more than a letterhead and business card, you know, or something like that. But in the main, these were design programs that had a total application. You know, it was to signing, to advertising, to communications, to television, building design, in some cases, facilities design. And, you know, there were, and vehicles of all kinds, including flying machines. So this idea of taking this kernel or this very simple element, but then applying it across the board, that's where you find out if it's successful or not in application. There can be thousands of applications. And that's great fun, but it's also exciting to the client to see that you knew what you were doing. I mean, because it just gets better. This is better as you expand it. So that's where I think the excitement goes in the fruition of a total program rather than just some little skyrocket. And I think that's one of the drives. Not that we haven't done our share of, you know, just publication design or web design where it's just, you know, over in an instant, because we have. But I think that's what's satisfying and kind of keeps you going, the things that touch the whole organization and the whole public more. You know, that's where the substance comes in, and that's what inevitably leads to, to a solution that is maybe a little more permanent and not so fashion-oriented, you know.
Most people don't like working when they're 82. Why do you continue to work?
Grass doesn't grow under my feet. I'm very active person, and I move from one thing to another. I've always had projects, and it would be either personal projects or commercial projects, but I stay young this way. And it's really been an advantage. On our farm in Oklahoma, I would stare at the stars and wondering what was out there, you know. And I just lie in the grass and you stare at the heavens. If there are no city lights, you cannot not wonder what's out there and what's really going on. And this is, of course, a long time ago. Now, I mean, as space exploration and astronomy and everything has moved forward, but that time it was more mystery than anything else.
So what was happening with space exploration then when you were, how old were you, like 10 when you remember this?
Well, yeah, there wasn't anything happening. I mean, there was spatial activity, but you know, it was more like scientific. And when we started to think in terms of manned flight and all that, then you were getting through the 50s, and then in early Jack Kennedy's administration, where he dedicated us to look at the moon by 69.
Well, how old were you? 30? Let's see, yeah, 35 for the moon landing, right?
Yeah, like that. So, I mean, I remember decidedly, because I started my practice in Dallas, I remember all the stuff that led up to the early, you know, Alan Shepard and the downrange shot, first man in space, but, you know, he just went downrange. And that was very, very exciting. We were all scared to death for him, you know, and these fledgling efforts. Well, anyway, it was terribly exciting then. And, of course, through the Apollo program or Gemini and Mercury, All of them were distinct and very powerful things. And of course, as I, like most Americans, were very drawn to it. Because as long as you have men in these machines, then it was very dangerous and scary. And it was a first for everything, because while we had done almost everything imaginable in an airplane, we hadn't done it in space. So I was just as taken, and probably more so than many people. I was also, from fairly early age, interested in extraterrestrial life. And I don't mean just chasing UFO stuff, you know, but I just was... just knew, as I still believe, there's plenty of life out there.
So humans have this history of using symbols for all kinds of things, including graphics or visual symbols. And now you were in charge of making a symbol that was in some ways going to represent humanity in space.
It's a big responsibility. I should quickly add that we was constantly reminded ourselves that we had a small firm, and Bruce Blackburn was my partner, and he was a big, important part of this process, especially early on. It was a joint responsibility.
Do you remember the first time that your word mark was sewn onto a patch, or you saw it on the side of a spacecraft, of a rocket? Do you remember the first time you actually saw it and it had become real?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the things that, if you put them on a scale of relativity, something like an embroidered patch, that happened within the first year, because we were testing all these threads out and making sure that they were non-flammable. So, you know, as you started building smaller things, packages and boxes and things, you know, like audio tape cartons and stuff for television. Well, we would see it being printed and woven and this and that. But it was still more theoretical. I think when the true impact came on the rocket and on the space shuttle itself. It was like almost no turning back then. Everything else in print is, as we've sort of been acknowledging, it's just temporary. You know, some of it's throwaway. But somehow in the three-dimensional, we started painting them. Now, this is in the first 2 years, let's say, after we'd done the manual. The manual continued to grow. So, yes, I would say the first time we saw a rocket, and certainly emphatically on the space shuttle, that really was profound. Well, it was almost like a higher calling, and it's such a deep intellectual involvement. I've always been interested in scientific things, but now I'm working on something that I really think is you know, changing the world, and it's a grand adventure. It's like nothing else. It's getting outside of ourselves and our own planet and out there. So it was it just on another, a totally different level. But I had a kind of different feeling about this than I've ever had about any other account. It was very healthy and exciting.
But at some point, they stopped putting your logo on the rockets.
Well, I got a call from my graphic coordinator, internal guy at NASA, Bob Shulman, who had been a tremendous ally all the years. And we had actually hired him after the program was in place, and to be the internal coordinator. And he gave us wind that something was up, and then to be prepared. And then, you know, about a week later, he called to confirm that they were reversing the program. Thank you. And of course, it was, frankly, it was crushing and very hard to take. But it was a decision made from above, so there's nothing we could do about it.
Did you know why?
The older fellows that had been in the agency for many, many years, they never did identify with the new logo. They were very steeped in the past. And, you know, with a meatball, I understand a lot. It was very emotional. And so they were calcified and didn't like change. And when Dan Golden came in, which was about, I want to say about 1991, they got his ear. And he was looking to change everything at the agency, but he was sort of, actually that was his mandate, I think, was to kind of shake up the agency. So his idea was to turn it upside down, and they were having a lot of budget cuts and radical stuff going on, so he wanted to just change the culture there. And his solution partly was to go backwards, you know. And I like to say that I'm still as immersed in the space program, and I follow everything with considerable interest. It's a little tainted now, you know. There'll always be sadness about it. Just really love the content of the space agency. So, you know, I wouldn't wish them any ill will. Rather, I want to see them to be successful. And still stare at the heavens and get some of the same feelings that I used to get.
How far into space has your logo gone? Was it after Voyager 1 and 2?
No, it's actually on those craft.
Really?
And they'll never retrieve them to repaint it.
Those are the farthest human-made objects from Earth right now.
Oh, no, it's definitely on the Voyager. That's one of my favorites. I did a supplement on space satellites.
You did a what?
A supplement for the manual. It applied the logo to the various spacecraft, but I did that one personally, and I really loved, well, who wouldn't? But I mean, the satellites were so exotic.
So Voyager 1 is pointed at the next planetary system,
mm-hmm.
where they hope to, you know, maybe there'll be something of interest there. I think if my memory serves me, your logo is going to arrive there in 40,000 years.
Now we're talking
permanence.
We're talking permanence.
It's getting there. Getting there. Almost all the music you heard on this episode was by Les Jupes, and one track by the Crooked Brothers as well. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. I wrote you a limerick. Remember, I was gonna. Yeah. So here. If I screw it up, we'll just start again. There once was a design called the meatball. It was hard to see quite what it was at all. Then a man named Dick got her done fixed, so all could see it, even if the rockets were tall.
Great.
So there you go.
Super. You're gonna send that to me, aren't you? Please.
Shall I write it on a card so you can put it on your fridge?
That sounds beautiful. Even better.